When I say space food, you say?
Ice cream.
Moon pie.
Neapolitan.
Moon pie. Orange.
Dried stuff.
Just an
orange.
Moon
pie. Astronaut ice cream.
Something light. So that it's easy to find.
Ice cream.
Astronaut ice cream.
Potato. The space potato.
Those were real voices from the streets of Washington, D.C. outside the museum. It was an appealing answer.
Yes.
It was a good answer. It was a...
Oh.
That shouldn't have taken me that long.
Welcome to Airspace, a podcast from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. We are your hosts.
I'm Matt Schindel.
I'm Emily Martin.
And I'm Nick Partridge.
This episode is all about space food.
Imagine if we could grow plants in space without water or soil.
Or print it, like in the Jetsons.
Turns out that's already happening.
And we'll talk about it.
And Matt goes behind the scenes with the National Air and Space Museum's curator of the space food collection. Valerie Neal tells us about some menu favorites.
You could choose anything from crawfish etouffee that you might find in New Orleans to tofu with hot mustard sauce.
And we all learn a little something about space currency.
The bacon squares were highly coveted, very good trading material, as a matter of fact.
Astronaut Harrison Schmidt shares this and other important lessons he learned during the Apollo 17 mission to the moon.
That's coming up next on Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum with help from PRX.
So, Nick, word on the street is that you've never tried astronaut ice cream, even though you work here in this museum.
Why? Who are you? Were you never a 7-year-old kid at a museum on a field trip?
So, here's a secret. I'm not actually a huge ice cream person.
But today, we're going to change that. We've got a little experiment for you.
What is this?
There's lots of crinkling.
Do you have sensitive teeth?
No.
Tell me that you like gelato or sorbet.
I mean, gelato's great.
Or
yeah,
something.
And, you know, I mean, contextually, like I'm not going to...
Contextually.
I'm not going to conspicuously not eat ice cream. Like there's just, it's so thick
wow.
And it just, yeah.
You have no
it's
good
so
excuse.
It's so rich and creamy and sweet and perfect.
Yeah. Perfection makes me uncomfortable. Like ice cream gives me an existential crisis. Nothing could be that good, right? But I don't intend to find out.
Hold on, I'm going to open this. Okay, left or right?
Left. All right.
Get ready for an astronaut ice cream sandwich.
Oh. The ice cream part is oddly insubstantial.
What do you mean?
It's
insubstantial,
like it kinda,
that sounds...
Well, it kind of just disappears.
It's got a melty quality to it, like ice cream, but it's like a warm melt.
Kind of like cotton candy melty.
Yeah, like cotton candy.
It's like dense cotton candy.
Yeah.
I mean...
Like calcified
you know,
cotton candy?
Astronaut ice cream has never made it into space. It's always been purely commercial.
Too crumbly. It would get in all of the instruments.
Yeah.
Do I have to eat the rest of it?
You do not.
So guys, real talk. There's a lot of stuff that you can and can't take into space for food because it can cause problems, right?
Example.
Example. If you were to bring bread or maybe crunchy potato chips, there's potential problems with crumbs getting out and into the ventilation.
I guess you could even breathe them in.
You could breathe them in. That could be tough if you started choking all of a sudden in your sleep.
Nowhere is safe from that.
But if you're just sleeping at home, only in space is bread the silent killer.
How are you keeping bread in your home that gravity is the only thing keeping you safe?
Okay. Actually, astronauts eat bread. It's just often in the form of tortillas to reduce the potential for crumbs. And they've been known to put all sorts of toppings on those tortillas.
I'd like to see what they can do with olives.
Like a nice tapenade?
Yeah.
Anything spreadable is good on the space station, I think.
And they preserve well.
I like that pepper and salt are in liquid form. You can't just sprinkle that on when you're in zero gravity because it won't fall onto the food. So you get little droppers of the stuff in a solution.
In the early days of space exploration, food was part of the exploration. The astronauts eating there were part of the experiment. Over time, as trips became more frequent and durations of trips were extended, the food, its preparation, transportation, and longevity evolved too. Dr. Valerie Neal is chair of the Space History Department in the National Air and Space Museum, and she's responsible for the space food collection. Some of it is on display, but a lot of it is kept in a special temperature-controlled area under lock and key and off-site. Valerie invited me to visit the collection. She walked me through some of its highlights.
We have a series of cabinets with large drawers in them.
So the space food is in here with a lot of other artifacts from the space program, spacesuits and space gear. On our right, we have racks, metal racks of spacesuit helmets. So it's kind of a cool, strange room to be in.
The cabinets don't necessarily say what food is in which cabinet, and they're just packed with samples going back to the Mercury missions in the early 1960s. And continuing all the way to the present with food from the International Space Station menu.
And in the Mercury mission, they really didn't know how space flight was going to affect digestion, is that right? So they were really experimenting with food.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this was something brand new, and nobody knew quite what the effect of microgravity would be. So there's some fundamental questions, like, can you really swallow, and will the food properly go through your digestive system? So that was actually one of the experiments that John Glenn performed.
And he ate applesauce, is that right?
Applesauce, right. And it was packed into a toothpaste tube, basically, so it was a very simple way of eating. Just pop the top off the tube and squeeze some into your mouth. And he reported no problem at all swallowing, and he also didn't have any problems with indigestion. And indigestion is actually a concern because in space, your food tends to, as you digest it, tends to float near the top of your stomach rather than the bottom of your stomach. And so some people have difficulty with burping or feeling like, you know, things just aren't going down well.
Yeah.
But physiologically, there's no problem because your body itself squeezes the food through the system.
Well, why don't we open one of these cabinets
sure.
and see
Let's
what's inside.
Sure, let's just see. Personal hygiene, food. Here's one that simply says food.
Okay.
And we'll open this cabinet. Can you unlock it there?
So we're looking at a drawer that is filled with these small plastic, almost Tupperware-style containers, about 10 by 10 in the drawer. So there's about 100, I think, with sort of dried-on gunk on the bottom. It doesn't really look very appetizing, does it?
No, not really. I'm sure it did when it was fresh, but as things age, they tend to go brown.
And each of the little containers kind of looks mostly empty. Is that because the food is dehydrated?
Exactly. So this little square container becomes like a bowl, and there's a little port here in the corner where the astronaut would put this up to the galley in the space shuttle, and there's a spigot for hot water or cold water, and you poke the needle in here, and each little container of food tells you how many ounces of hot or cold water to use, and then you will have something tasty, like in this case, orange juice. Doesn't look at all like orange juice right
now.
It looks kind of like a prune juice, caked prune juice. And you'll notice that on these paper labels that describe the contents of the food, there's also a little yellow sticky dot, and that indicates which crew member's food this is.
Oh.
So by the 1990s, NASA gave up these rigid plastic Tupperwares and went to vacuum-sealed pouches, a sturdy vinyl baggie with the port at the top, and you would squirt the hot or cold water in and then mush with your hands and get your food reconstituted. And here's another type of, it's in a can, a pop-top can. Can you see what it says?
Ham salad spread.
Ham salad spread, all right.
Now, I've read that on at least one of the Apollo missions, they brought ham sandwiches with them.
Not ham sandwiches, a corned beef sandwich.
Ah.
Gemini 3, I think it was, John Young sneaked one aboard for Gus Grissom, and they got into trouble for that. There was actually a congressional hearing. Health is an issue anytime you have people in a closed environment. They're rebreathing the same air, they're recycling their water, and there's real concern about any kind of bacteria getting loose. So part of the reason that the foods are prepared the way they are is to sterilize them. We talked about the dehydrated food, but thermostabilized food like the puddings and a lot of the entrees, let's say chicken a la king or something, will have been thermostabilized, which is a fancy word for canning.
So that's really an ancient technology of canning, heating right. things up and storing them.
And then the third way is irradiation, and they do that on meat products like steak or hamburger. Let's see what this is. Okay, here's an example. Rhubarb applesauce. Now, this would be thermostabilized, and this is more contemporary. You can see it has a barcode mm-hmm. on it, and I believe it has both Russian and English. So there might be one little suitcase that is pouch like that of applesauce, and another might be a whole row of cherry cobbler or apple cobbler, that sort of thing. And on the International Space Station, instead of having a menu set for you in it, you just go and pull from the meat you want, from the vegetable container, whatever vegetable you want.
Oh, so you can make a different decision every day.
Every day,
instead
exactly.
of having to have everything planned.
Right. There is Chinese food or Japanese food on the space station. There's now vegan and vegetarian food. There's low-sodium food and low-fat food if you have dietary issues. But if you look at the menu, you could choose anything from crawfish etouffee that you might find in New Orleans or East Texas and Louisiana to tofu with hot mustard sauce. Yeah. And for the holidays, the astronauts do like to have a holiday meal together that's very traditional. So let's look in another drawer and see what we have here. Cherry dessert. Ooh, yum.
Are those M&Ms?
Well, it says mint M&Ms. They're green and brown. These are great for playing with your food in space because astronauts will take a handful of toss them up in the air, and then everybody becomes a guppy floating around and snapping at M&Ms.
Well, the same food eaten on Earth will taste different in space, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and why do you think that is?
Well, I've heard that it's because, you know, without gravity, a lot of your sort of sinus fluids just build up in your head, right? Is that what it is?
Well, fluids that are normally pulled down into your legs and feet kind of migrate up into your torso and all the way up into your head. And you know how when you have a cold, your taste buds are affected and everything tastes bland?
Oh, yeah.
That's what it's like for them. Mm. And as a result, the number one most favorite food in space is shrimp cocktail. But a shrimp cocktail with horseradish sauce, you know, to get that spiciness. And if you look carefully at pictures of the dining area on the International Space Station in the Russian component, you'll see behind an elastic band against one of the cabinets, sriracha sauce, taco sauce, Tabasco sauce, all these hot, spicy
yeah,
sauces.
All the spiciest sauces you can get, I
exactly.
guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I haven't heard of anybody putting sriracha sauce on their dessert yet, but it's conceivable.
You know, we've discussed how I'm not the biggest ice cream person in the world, but if you wanted to add hot sauce to ice cream, I would give it a go.
I mean, that's maybe taking the sweet, salty thing a little far for me.
My wife Liz once made me a birthday cake that was a chocolate chili cake. It
Ooh,
was a chocolate
that
chili
sounds delicious.
Chocolate birthday cake with chocolate cinnamon frosting.
I mean, I can see the whole
it was really, really something.
Chocolate chili situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm totally down with astronauts on the hot sauce.
Now, if it was possible, would either of you, Nick or Emily, volunteer to be a food tester in the space food lab?
Yes. I did hear that in order for space food to pass the test, to actually become something that's a menu item, it needs to make it through at least 3 flights on what is called the Vomit Comet, which is essentially this plane that flies up and down and up and down and up and down. And on the downs, it essentially gives you a sense of weightlessness or 0G. And so apparently any space food that becomes spaceworthy has to be able to make it through at least 3 of these trips. And I think those trips are used to actually test the delivery methods for these different foods to actually make sure that they aren't super crumbly and that all the things that they've done or what they're expecting the food to do.
It's but, not about whether the food becomes vomit in the comet.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you fly on the Vomit Comet, they actually put hack sacks in like your sleeves and inside your jumpsuit so that just in case you're trying to be a hero, they don't want you throwing up everywhere.
So we've just upped the ante of what it means to be a space food taste tester.
Oh, yeah. The Apollo 17 mission was the Apollo mission that spent the most time on the surface of the moon. And Harrison Schmitt was one of the astronauts on that mission. So that means he would have consumed a lot of moon meals.
His frequent diner card was fully punched.
He got his 10th meal for free.
He got his 10th meal for free.
The taxpayers paid, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually asked him to talk with me about eating in space, and it turns out he had quite a number of food adventures. More on that after the break. Astronaut Harrison Schmitt traveled to space in December 1972 on the Apollo 17 mission. He was the lunar module pilot. His crewmates were Commander Eugene Cernan and Command Module Pilot Ronald Evans.
And didn't Harrison Schmitt take the famous blue marble photo of the Earth? The image that shows nearly the entire sphere of the Earth visible against the dark sky?
That's right, he did. And I asked him about that photo.
It turned out to be one of the most popular photographs that's ever been taken. I think NASA still says that it is the most requested photograph from their archives.
The photo is pretty iconic. When I look at that photograph, I sort of picture him on the other side of the camera. And for the purposes of this episode, let's say I imagine him eating space food thousands of miles away from home. When we talked, he explained that sometimes it's not easy to want to eat space food in space, but not for the reasons I thought he might mention.
One of the problems you have is that your appetite is suppressed when you're weightless, and you're not working as hard as you do normally here on Earth just to stand or move around. And so you really, to keep your energy levels up where they ought to be, you eat more food than you really desire.
So when you designed your own menu for Apollo, what were the things that you chose?
Well, we were always looking for something with some flavor to it. And I guess that the champion in that respect were the bacon squares. Like the ads for dogs, we really did go after those bacon squares and tried to get as many of them in the menu as we could.
So bacon is popular even in space. That's good to know.
It has, you know, it's salty and it has flavor, and we were really looking for things with flavor. And the meals changed somewhat through the Apollo program. I think they got new ideas, and at one point they added additional potassium to some of the juices and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
There was certainly a good rationale for it, but they probably overdid that.
Right. I've heard that it ended up giving some astronauts some bad gas.
To say the least, yes.
Which is not what you want when you're in a confined environment.
Not at all.
Were there particular times when you just felt very hungry? I mean, after a long day of work on the moon, I'd imagine you would.
Yes, the reason you're hungry is that you're in a pressure suit. The suit pressure's 3.7 pounds per square inch. Every time you move, you're doing work at that pressure. And even though it's 1/6 gravity, you are indeed using up a significant amount of energy, particular upper body energy, because you're doing things with your arms almost continuously. It's pretty easy to run on the moon. I found that a cross-country skiing gait was the best way to run on the moon. Hmm. But nevertheless, you're working for 9-10 hours, physically working. And so that tends to create a pretty healthy appetite. Each meal after the excursion, after the hard work, we ate essentially everything that was in that meal and then some. The only food we had to eat while we were in the suit with the helmet on was a long fruit stick that was inserted into a holder that you could just reach with your mouth and your teeth. And you had to do it right. You had to remember to pull that out before you took a bite. If you didn't, if you took a bite, then you might never get to that fruit stick again.
So did you and Gene Cernan eat meals together while on the moon?
We ate meals together both in the Apollo spacecraft as well as in the Lunar Module Challenger. But on the moon, we really only had two meals a day because most of the time we were outside the spacecraft working, exploring the Valley of Taurus Littrow. We'd have a breakfast and then a dinner. First time we had a meal on the moon, Cernan reached over and opened up the compartment and it exploded. The packages of food had enough air in them that they had, in the reduced atmospheric pressure of the spacecraft, food came piling out onto the floor of the Challenger. And so we had, we took our first meal out of it, and then the food was all connected. Every food pouch was connected to another food pouch by fish line. And so we stuffed everything else back in the compartment as best we could.
What was the ambiance like of eating either in the lunar module or in the command module when you would have a meal? I mean, in the command module, I assume you just remain seated in your seat, but...
Well, in the command module, of course, you're not seated because that implies you have gravity. What you do is you just strap yourself loosely into the seat just to maintain a little body control. Usually, I think Ron Evans would be distributing the food since he knew where it was stored better than we did. And as he distributed the food, you just pass around the water gun for rehydration. The water gun would give you, with every trigger pull, would give you about an ounce of water, so you could calibrate how much water you wanted to put in any particular pouch. And then you'd cut the pouch open and use a spoon. Mm. The dominant force that you have in space, once you're weightless, is surface tension. And so a spoon works very well, so long as you don't move it too fast, and the food comes out and starts drifting around the cockpit. And then if you don't catch it in a hurry, it's going to end up in the in the ventilating fans.
Did you have any runaway food on your mission?
We almost lost a bacon square once. And that would have been a severe loss. As I indicated earlier, the bacon squares were highly coveted, very good trading material, as a matter of fact. If your colleague had some food that you decided you want, a chocolate bar or something like that, you could almost certainly trade him a bacon square for that particular item. We made sure that that bacon square didn't get away from us. That was a big issue with leaving Ron Evans alone in that spacecraft as we were working on the moon, because Ron was a chow hound. For some reason, his appetite wasn't diminished by being in space. And we were concerned that there would not be much of anything left by the time we got back to orbit from the moon. And indeed, all the bacon squares that were allocated for our return trip to Earth had disappeared by the time we got there.
Well, I think we know what the currency of space is going to be if we ever do become an interplanetary species. I think bacon, it sounds like, is going to be worth more than gold.
When I think of bacon squares, I think of that gum that Violet chews in Willy Wonka.
This little piece of gum is a three-course dinner.
So when I think of a bacon square, because when she first takes that piece of gum, it's like this little brown cube.
Holy Toledo, what's happening to your face?
Cool it, Dad. Let me finish.
Yeah, but your face is turning blue. Violet, you're turning violet, Violet.
What are you talking about?
Violet, you're turning violet. What would you trade your Willy Wonka gum or bacon squares for?
I would trade...
Or would you just hoard them?
Maybe.
I'll tell you what I would take. You know what I think would do well in space are like those mozzarella cheese sticks that you can buy, like the string cheese.
Yeah,
string cheese.
I know, but like you've got bacon squares. Your buddy up there on the surface of the moon, maybe you've got two buddies. I don't know. They've got something you want.
Uh-huh.
What is it that they have you want more than that bacon square?
Moon rocks. I was one of the guys in the ship.
You guys suck at this game.
Nick, we're supposed to be talking about food, not rocks.
You don't get to keep any of the rocks. It's a federal offense.
Tea, Earl Grey hot.
Yes.
Oh, you guys are killing me.
Yeah, what I think of when I think of like the future of space food is the Star Trek replicator, right? Where you can tell the computer what you want and the computer just puts it in front of you as you order it.
Water, cold.
Now, we don't have that technology of making something out of nothing, but I've heard that we have maybe the ability to 3D print some foods.
Yeah, it was something that was on display at South by Southwest this year. And it's a Japanese company called Open Meals, and they actually sort of fill a 3D printer with little bits of gel that each cube of gel, which counts as a pixel, gets infused with a certain amount of color and a certain amount of flavor of the thing that you're trying to print. And the end result, apparently, is not particularly delicious, but has a very cool 8-bit super pixelated, think like early video games.
So it's like eating inside of Mario Brothers.
It's like eating inside of Mario Brothers on your Sega Genesis.
Oof.
But you still can't escape the weight of that food substrate that you have to put up into orbit.
But you're also not stuck with, like, we brought X number of
fettuccine Alfredos.
Yeah, exactly. You can make your decisions as you go.
Delicious, delicious substrate.
Delicious,
like, do you think
substrate.
There's going to be, like, an astronaut that, like, gets tired of, like, the printed substrate, and so he's just, like, in the back of the machine eating the substrate directly out of the pot?
Well, he can just make it from his poop.
That's valid. No, that was something that was
right.
Something we
were. So, still not something from nothing, but something that most of us don't want to think about is making food out of our own waste.
But there is a group out of Penn State working on this system.
So
keep it together.
I'll ask you again. Do you want to be a taste tester for space food?
I'm just saying. I have heard that this idea is not gaining any more currency with astronauts than it is with us now.
But they're already drinking. I mean, on the space station, they're already making some of their drinking water out of their urine.
Yeah.
So why? I mean, it doesn't feel like that much of a leap.
That doesn't feel like that much of a leap. That is one giant leap for space kind.
They did it in The Martian. We're going to keep talking about
it. Well, right. The Martian, or if you think about the way that we get our food on this planet, right?
Right.
We grow food basically in the waste products of animals, of bacteria.
Sure. With a lot of richly
harvested. All of those nutrients go back into us, but they go through nature first. This would be sort of taking nature out of the equation and throwing it into a machine, just reforming some form of food.
If any of our listeners are at Penn State and would like to let us know what the dining halls there are like, we would be interested in whether or not the scope of this experiment has expanded.
So poop food is pretty gross for obvious reasons, and I think we should move on to a less disgusting topic. There's a pretty exciting line of research going on trying to grow food in a different way called aeroponics.
That sounds much more appetizing and like a much safer vein of conversation.
Yeah. So imagine a garden where you don't have to get your hands dirty, where you're using just a little bit of water, no soil, and no sunlight.
But it actually has a lot of artificial light that they're using to grow the plants, because of course plants photosynthesize. You can't grow plants without some kind of light. And in Antarctica, actually, where they're doing some of these experiments and testing some of these technologies, they're actually doing this in a shipping container, and you're controlling the sort of essentially the atmosphere inside the container, and essentially attached with a giant sad machine, a giant light machine in there that's kind of making sure those plants are growing happy and healthy. So if you think about
it, the vegetables that are being produced with aeroponics actually look pretty good. I don't think they're going to win any 4-H fairs anytime soon, but...
But why not?
Well, they're just, they're not growing the world's biggest pumpkin, but, you know, the food looks good.
How big does a pumpkin have to be to hold a record in space, though?
Well, true. I think, you know, I don't know if we've flown a pumpkin yet.
I'm sure they've flown at least a slice of pumpkin pie for those astronauts who are in their missions during Thanksgiving.
You can throw a pie at someone from like a mile away.
I don't think the gravity is that low on Mars.
You don't know how hard I can throw a pie.
And you don't know how light and airy his pies are. Airspace, delivered pre-mixed, no rehydration required, from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, with help from PRX. The producer of Airspace is Jocelyn Frank. Our executive producer is Katie Moyer. Special thanks to John Barth and PRX, Jason Orfanen, and Tarek Fuda. You can subscribe to Airspace wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was supported by PRX and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org.
Computer, Earl Grey, hot. Wait.
From PRX.